Good afternoon. I'm David Soibert, and I'm chairing this afternoon's session. We have one panelist, and I know other conference people have to bounce at 3:30 to catch flights to the airport, so I'm going to get things going. There are two handouts by the back door. If people want those, a couple of handouts prepared by one of our panelists, Joshua Sternfeld from NEH. Just to frame the session today, we're going to do something a little different than what might normally be constituted as a funders panel. A typical funders panel might be where we have representatives from a number of grant-giving agencies doing short presentations on what sort of programs they have, what are the funding amounts, what are the requirements for giving grants and things like that. But we've had a good dialogue going today, and I think what we really need is an opportunity for some exchange of ideas between funders and the arts community rather than just a talk on what sort of funding is available. So it's going to be a little bit more free form. Rather than taking questions at the end, we kind of want to leave the floor open through the entire time. So keep that in mind. I don't want it to go off the rails with too much of a free-for-all. But I think there's stuff to be learned by our funders, as well as information to be learned from all of us as well. And the other thing is that I think that most of us, first and foremost in our minds, we think of really the desperate need for funding for sort of boots-on-the-ground preservation. I've got a collection that's on failing media, and I need to locate a source of funding in order to save that collection. I think that's how a lot of us have framed this issue. I wanted to broaden it up a little bit more than that. And we've heard this morning with education and training, research and development, and these are all areas in which I think ARSC should be looking and exploring funding opportunities. Things like research and development may not be funding the preservation of a particular collection or something like that, but it's groundwork that needs to be laid in order to do that other sort of work. So think very broadly about funding. This is not about funding specifically for preservation, but funding that will advance the field, and if you'll pull out your hymnal, advance the cause of this. What are the funding opportunities that we can apply to the plan in order to successfully implement portions? And the way I look at the plan, too, is out of all of the bullet points, there is no funding bullet point. But there are bullet points for things like expanding the capacity of preservation or education and training. And those are all funding, contingent upon funding. In a sense that money is going to solve our problems. We can apply that money to various issues in the plan, but we need to address funding for almost every one of these issues in here, so keep that in mind. But that's the end of my lecture. What I want to do now is introduce our panelists, and then I'm going to turn the floor over to Gerald Seligman, who is the executive director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation, and he'll really make the first formal introduction of the foundation to the ARSC membership and outline its goals and objectives. So I'll start out by introducing Gerald. He is an international music industry professional with over 30 years experience in both major and independent music and music events companies. He is the executive director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation through the U.S. Library of Congress, a public-private partnership established to preserve and make accessible the recorded sounds of the United States. He is also president of Caravan Arts Consultancy, his own company from which he collaborates and or consults with events, companies, governmental and non-governmental organizations throughout the world. Current and recent clients include the Borneo World Music Expo, which he is creating and directing, the Indian Ocean Music Market, which he co-directs, the first Mercado Centroamericano de la Música in Costa Rica, three separate arts projects in Minas Gerais, if I said that correct, in Brazil, and the Korean Arts Council. He has also advised UNESCO on its Cultural Cities Project, the World Bank on an African Arts and Crafts Music Initiative, and was on the steering committee for an ongoing Africa-Caribbean Pacific project for the European Commission. Until November 2009, Gerald was director of WOMEX, the World Music Expo in Berlin. He was also co-founder and first chairman of Free Muse, the human rights organization based in Copenhagen, Denmark. He founded and ran EMI Hemisphere, the company's premier world music label, and was head of EMI's international sector for strategic marketing in London, covering archive, catalog, premiums, and special projects, with 43 countries reporting in and ultimately delivering EMI's major profit share. He has also produced or compiled over 100 releases, including a Grammy-nominated release. So we're very pleased to have Gerald here at ARSC today, as well as, don't get up just yet, I'll do all of the introductions. We're very pleased to have him here at ARSC, though, and we're also very pleased to have him as the executive director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation. Also on the panel today, we have, do you want to bring up Josh? We have Joshua Sternfeld with the National Endowment from the Humanities in Washington, D.C., and he is Skyping in for us to join us today, and we thank him for doing that. And he also listened to both the morning presentations to get the context of the plan as well. Since 2009, he has served as Senior Program Officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Division of Preservation and Access in Washington, D.C. He holds a BA in history from Princeton and a PhD in history from UCLA, specializing in modern European cultural history and jazz studies. In his free time, Josh presents and publishes on digital history. Finally, I'd like to welcome Al Schlockmeyer. He's a veteran of the private sector and a lifelong record collector. He's worked as a pro bono contractor for the Library of Congress and was instrumental in setting up the ARSC Classical Recordings Preservation Award. Recently, he completed a project with George Blood to digitize a portion of the United Nations Archive of Concert Recordings. So please welcome our presenters today. And to start off, I'm going to turn it over to Gerald to give us an introduction to the foundation.
Don't I get sworn in on the plan?
On him.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. There's an awful lot I don't have to say, obviously, enough in front of a group like this, since you know all of us have very similar intentions, if differing personal interests and priorities. So I'd like to tell you a bit about the National Recording Preservation Foundation. Beyond the fact that it's very hard to say after a glass of wine, and how it came about and what it is we intend to do. And we heard some talk this morning about the National Film Preservation Board, and in a lot of ways, the act of Congress that created the Film Preservation Board had similar intentions in mind for us. They were created in 1988, we in 2000. However, thanks to donors like Martin Scorsese, the Film Foundation got up and running very quickly, and frankly is a real model for us as we set up the Recording Preservation Foundation. It was, as Pat Lockney said, an act of Congress that created it, and there's a very interesting relationship that the foundation has with the Library of Congress. We are not actually an arm of the Congress, although we are fully committed to the plan and doing what we can to help implement it. It's a public-private foundation. And so therefore, because we work with the Library of Congress, and in fact they've helped with some initial funding to get us up and running, we can benefit from their expertise and do already, and its professionals. And some help in the funding in that startup I mentioned. But we're also quite independent in that the projects that we choose and the priorities we establish are very much directed by the board itself and the director. We don't have to answer to to the Library of Congress to make sure that we're aligned with that kind of degree of attention. So we benefit greatly from this relationship because we are working with them, we're working directly with them, we can benefit from their expertise, but we also have an autonomy that allows us to also work within the community to try to understand what the community needs and devise our own solutions or suggestions for how best to enact some of those priorities. So it also frees us up a bit, I think, in terms of fundraising. You know, it would be hard to imagine being a government agency and going to artists, to musicians, and saying, we would like you to give us money. I think it's much easier as an independent. So the remit, of course, is familiar enough. As we've all discussed, it's to marshal the expertise of professionals, to reach out to the community at large, like ARSC and others, and to build support to preserve the nation's audio treasures. Build support and also communicate to the public at large the very issues that make preservation such a priority for all of us. As we all know, it's not a message that's gotten out in any effective way to the public at large. And I think we might be in a position to be able to help somewhat in that. Part of the reason for that is because of a remarkable board that we have, that I inherited. And on the board are some very well-known artists, T-Bone Burnett, Jack White, and Ricky Miner, who's the music director for The Tonight Show. So we've got three prominent artists, some with tremendous respect within the industry and amongst their peers, and also very big followings. Our chairman is John Simpson, who was formerly the CEO of Sound Exchange. George Massenberg is on the board as well to help advise us on technical issues. Because our remit, and this is something we very much need to communicate at large, goes beyond music to all manner of audio and radio and all the rest, we have Davia Nelson of the Kitchen Sisters, who's on our board. And we have industry professionals, John Poneman of Sub Pop, and Bruce Lundvall, the president emeritus of Blue Note, and an angel. And from NARAS Grammy Museum, we have Bob Santelli. So it's an interesting mix of people. From the library itself, I have a lot of contact with Pat Lockney. And frankly, if it wasn't for Pat's efforts over these recent years, we wouldn't have begun to get off the ground the way we are now. It really took a champion inside because it was created in 2000. Here we are in 2013, and we're really only just beginning now. So I really acknowledge Pat's contribution in that. And I also have the benefit of people like Sam Brailovsky, who I've increasingly come to notice, he gives advice in concentrate. It tends to expand with time. An increase in volume, the more I think about the kinds of things that he suggests. I became director in November, so this is very recent. And in every way, we're at the beginning. It's been a part-time position up until now, and what it's meant is that we were first trying to formulate what our role should be and how we can interact. And so I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I do want to say that we've just received a major contribution, which means that we can go from theory to practice, and we intend over the next 12 months to start giving out our first grants and also, figuring out the relationship. So it's very much a phase of mapping out the territory. My own background, as you heard, is not in preservation. Mine is in artisan repertoire and events and development projects. So from that perspective, I've got a lot to learn. But what I'm hoping is that because of our access to the industry, we might be able to get higher level meetings with the right kind of decision makers within major companies who own such big archives that perhaps the academic side or the collector side is not able to. I mean, if T-Bone calls up the head of Warner Brothers or the head of Universal, you know, we'll get a meeting. And he and Jack are very active in our interests and will do anything we ask them to along those lines. So again, what I'm figuring out, and I'm going to pretty much end my comments, is the relationship and how best we can serve the community. So one is figuring out how our unique positioning, this kind of public-private, this relationship with the Library of Congress, the constituency we have on the board, the artists, the engineers, how we can best use this rather unique dynamic, and which projects we should champion. So I appreciate being here, and I want to end with just some of my own thinking at this point, because once again, we are very new and just formulating. I am the only employee at this point. And so over the next year, we will start becoming, my hours will increase. I will start, enlisting the help of others, and we can start giving out grants. So my questions at this point are not rhetorical. And I'm hoping to leave here having given out a whole pocket full of cards so that we can begin a conversation and really significantly enhance it over time. So my questions are, what is the best role, as I just said, for our unique combination of factors and dynamic? How much of our role as the foundation should be educational and helping to coordinate educational efforts? And how much project generation we should do of our own compared to how we can best support existing projects from people such as yourselves? And we will, maybe in 6 months would be my guess, put together a grant evaluating committee and begin dispersing money and certainly raising more. So the other question for us will be how to select projects. I think it's very important for us to especially for the initial projects, unfortunately the need is so big that there's not, we'll have to do some pretty strict selection and develop criteria. So initially what I'm hoping to do is to find and choose and work with and help fund the kinds of projects that will help communicate what the preservation needs are, the reality, and the efforts. So to find those projects that combines a really press-worthy, press-interesting project with some real need. Also how to communicate that certainly we're interested in music preservation, but the whole issue is bigger to audio preservation of all kinds. And how much, of an advocate we should be. And how to develop partnerships with projects so that we don't duplicate things that are already being done, but instead help enhance the ones that are already being enacted or contemplated. So once again, I thank all of you for this opportunity, and I really hope to be able to give out a lot of cards and have a lot of real conversations, and I promise those were not rhetorical. They're real questions.
Thanks, Gerald. Can we bring Josh back up now, too? Thank you for the introduction to the foundation. I want to move it into that question-answer portion, and I'm going to pose a couple questions to start off, first to Josh and then to Al as well, get their thoughts on preservation and funding opportunities and needs. But I guess to start off, Josh, what are the concerns that you see that need to be addressed as far as audio preservation, and how might NEH fit into those, in addressing those concerns?
Okay, well, thank you, David. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah. Yep. Oh, if my audio goes out, then if someone can raise their hand or wave it, then that would be great. David, I guess your question is quite a huge one, and I'm glad for the opportunity to be able to begin to chip away at it from NEH's perspective. As some of you may know, audio preservation and audiovisual preservation has been one of our top priorities throughout our grant programming for the last several years. We have a fairly good history in terms of preserving specific collections, as well as funding some of the major projects that have been discussed even here today in the couple of panels that have been delivered surrounding the Library of Congress plan, including the Irene project that Carl and Peter were talking about, as well as sound directions that were handled out of Harvard and Indiana. So from, you know, in talking with David and the rest of the panel, one of the things that we came to a kind of an agreement was that, you know, the approach of a collection by collection project basis is probably not going to have as much of an impact as a couple of other different approaches that may be more worthwhile for ARTS to consider. Many of you are probably familiar with our sort of what we call our bread and butter grant program. I forget who mentioned it this morning, but we have a July deadline coming up for what's called our Humanities Collections and Reference Resource Program. And that's really a collections-specific program. You come to us with a highly significant for humanities research and educational opportunities kind of collection, and you say, okay, we need to work on reformatting and digitization, et cetera. And we're happy to accept those projects. And the handout that I provided in the back lists that even just a sampling of some of the projects we funded in the last few years. But in terms of the context of today's talks and the report that has been the focus of these panels, the question is, can NEH and can funders support matters at a more kind of national or national level? And for that, I would point to several of our other grant programs that are probably better equipped to handle some of the activities, action items that have come up throughout our discussions today. The two that are probably most relevant are education and training and research and development. So I'm the coordinator for the research and development program. So that's a little bit more in my wheelhouse, but I've spoken to actually several of my colleagues about the education and training program. We had a couple of powwow sessions to strategize how to present ENT to the ARTS community. And given all of the ideas and possible directions that were raised in relation to education and training, specifically the development of graduate programs, master's levels programs, as well as the professional training that can be delivered to at the most basic level to archivists that may have little to no audio preservation training, or at a more advanced level for audio preservationists that are looking to keep up with the latest best practices and standards. So I think one of the things that I'd like to do today is, in the course of our discussion, is spell out a couple of different directions in terms of projects that we have received at NEH that has had either a regional or national impact for an entire preservation community. Our history goes back several decades. We've had SAA come to us and develop significant national programs back in the early 1990s. More recently, we've developed a program in coordination, starting with Cornell University, but that's mushroomed outward around digital preservation education and training. I think you know, one thing that I'd like to throw back to the audience today is to ask the question of what you think is the most pressing needs in terms of ENT. You can certainly throw ideas back at me, and we can kind of even have a back and forth in terms of what would probably have a more successful outcome from NEH's perspective. And the same goes for research and development. As I mentioned before, Sound Directions and Irene comes out of our R&D program. We're very proud of those projects. But I would say probably in the last few years, the AV community has probably had a larger success rate than the audio community in terms of receiving funding from R&D. We've had several projects just in the last two or three years, one coming out of University of Wisconsin dealing with the study of nitrate film. We have a project that is underway at the University of South Carolina that's dealing with the digitization of optical sound to reduce the amount of time it takes to digitize both image and sound through film. And I think the project also comes to mind from last year that we funded with the Bay Area Video Coalition. They're developing a tool, which is a diagnostic tool, to assess the quality of digital video. And so I think you can even, with those couple of projects, get a sense of the range of types of projects that we fund through R&D, from tools to platform developments to the very kinds of physical conservation-oriented, conservation science-oriented projects. So I'll leave it at that, and I think I can sort of fill in some of the details about some of the projects I mentioned, as well as some questions you might have in terms of our own funding history, and perhaps what I hope is that that you guys can walk away with a few ideas, with a sense that NEH is there to support audio preservation at this kind of national level that's been under discussion throughout today.
Thanks, Josh. I'd like to pose a similar question to Al. Al, you started the Ars Classical Preservation Grants Program. Is it about 10 years now or 8 years?
2004, so yeah, it's about 8 years.
And when you set that up, what were the concerns that prompted you to address that yourself? And 8, 9 years later, what are the concerns you see, or how has that changed? And if you could talk about funding approaches for the preservation of actual content.
Yeah, I think my focus in setting it up was concentration that a narrowly focused funding opportunity and process could lead to. This is exclusively on classical music, consciously and only. And I just knew that there were, from lots of personal experiences, small archives and small areas of potentially valuable and interesting items that deserved some attention. And I didn't see it being reached in any other way. ARSC was a good platform for it. And these have turned out to be universities, concert organizations, relatively small collections. These are not large grants that we're giving by any stretch, but it gives an alternative to the market for this sort of thing that I think was not present before. And that's really what I was doing it for. And I'm pleased, and I'm not alone in funding it. I mean, there are a lot of people who are also involved in it, that I think it's achieved those goals largely. They are limited goals, but when you do limited goals, you can track them better, and you can administer them better, I think, at least on the part-time volunteer basis that we have here. And it's worked. I'm pleased with it, and I hope to see it continue for a long time to come. I think some of the lessons learned can also be applied to a situation like this. If there's a role for Or to what extent is there a role for individual small contributions associated with this? Gerald, I think it was great for you to have pointed up the need, and Joshua as well, for public support of this, not just for the purposes of encouraging Congress and maintaining the mission and all the rest of it, but perhaps for exploring some non-traditional, individual and diverse funding alternatives that may not have been tried before, that could also contribute toward the profile in the public's mind of what this is all about. And I'm thinking here of campaigns that are associated with media sales of various kinds. I'm thinking of even something as bizarre, perhaps, as a kind of a kickstart approach on the web, where there would be an opportunity for an individual to put $5, $25, or whatever, toward the preservation of something that that individual might be interested in supporting. Because my experience, my own personal feeling, is that donors donate to get you to do the work they want done. So there isn't always the coordination and the coincidence of what an institution wants and needs and what an individual donor wants to donate for. So maybe there is some different ways of looking at this whole problem. So that's my thought.
Thanks. Maybe I could throw that question out to the audience as well, if they want to address the concerns you see as being pressing and how maybe we could align the needs of the preservation community with the various funding agencies we have here, as well as the funding agencies that aren't here, such as Mellon and the Grammy Foundation and other agencies that are making grants in this area. Does anybody have any input that they'd like to? Or Gerald, do you have any further thoughts on this?
I'd like to offer the thought that there are, this is great that this Recording Preservation Foundation has started and that individuals are already funding small scale projects and so on, and the NEH has been doing this for some time, but I do think this is an opportunity to take the message to the large established foundations that make grants at a substantial level. I'm thinking of the Ford Foundation and Carnegie and other foundations. Mellon has given foundations for film preservation, but if you look through the grant statements in the foundation directories, not a lot of them actually specifically single out audiovisual materials or recorded sound materials. And to me, this is a really important opportunity to sort of get the message out to these traditional grant funding organizations that have done so much to save American culture broadly, from architecture to the arts and sciences, to get them to begin to think in terms of audio materials, which I think is really important. So I think this is a valuable and important time.
And we have a powerful tool now as well, that when submitting, and Josh, tell me whether you would agree with this, but when submitting proposals to funders, that you can point to a particular, where, you know, we're not only are we doing this, but by doing this, we're helping to address issue number 2.1.1 or something like that. And I think that would be a compelling argument and a proposal. Would you agree with that, Josh?
I have a sense that a question has been thrown my way. I have to say the audio is a little shaky. So if maybe David, if you can repeat the question.
Sure,
I'm trying my best to listen in.
Should we reposition the laptop?
Yeah, that might be best. I'm getting about half of what people are saying.
Okay, wonder if we should. Well,
we're going to work on that.
We'll come back to that.
As I'm being adjusted, I'd like to actually throw in one comment in terms of what was just raised in the audience in terms of raising audio visual audio preservation as a national awareness kind of issue, and I guess I'm heartened to hear that Gerald's foundation is modeled very closely after the National Film Preservation Foundation, which has historically had a very successful relationship with NEH. As many of you might be aware, you know, our Jefferson Lecture, which is our sort of main highlight lecturer slash speaker every year, this year was Martin Scorsese. And if you haven't listened to his talk, it's actually available on our website, neh.gov. He gave you know, a fantastic hour-long lecture, the final third, I would say a good 20 minutes of which was dedicated directly with film preservation. So we were, you know, my own office was thrilled to hear what he had to say about the need for film preservation, and the foundation that, you know, he's involved with has had a very successful history with NEH, receiving grant awards for their Treasures series. I don't know if anyone in the audience is familiar with their this series of DVDs that were produced. These were done as box sets. You can actually go on Amazon and order them. There was a selection process with each grant application to select some of the most rare and in danger silent films, and that process helped produce, gosh, at least three major grant awards through NEH. So all by way of saying, you know, the foundation doesn't just have to be a relationship with private foundations. It can also be with public public funding opportunities, including NEH.
And of course, an hour-long speech by Martin Scorsese is 3 hours of information. He talks fast. You can't hear us, can you?
Oh, now you can hear us, can you? Ah, great.
Yes.
Great. Okay, now we've got that.
May I ask something?
Yes, absolutely.
Yep. Josh, one of the things we were talking about yesterday was the kinds of grant proposals that tend to get more attention and that are more often approved. And I had an experience on a grant panel for the European Commission, and I did it in part to try to figure out how it all worked. But what I noticed were the grants that everyone took seriously, and then in my own successes, was to go beyond the thought of my particular project, but to try to link it to others or to create networks so that the money that would be given would not only help a given project, but also help create a foundation that could then be built upon and go beyond the grant money to show that it had a second life and a third. I wonder if you could talk about how individuals, because we're all very unique individuals with our own projects, how we might band together in ways that would meet with more approval, a higher success rate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I can finally hear it. thanks for the question. I think, you know, as I think you hit the nail right on the head, David. And, you know, one of the operative words is, I think in the context of today, is collaboration or networking. And, you know, as resources become scarcer in all areas, what we're finding are, you know, communities are getting more and more creative in leveraging the resources that they do have. So in terms of, for example, education and training, I can foresee a fantastic project coming our way that is delivered through ARSC. You know, it would be fantastic to see ARSC, you know, the association as the lead quote-unquote institution or organization that is thinking in a kind of broader context, a broader scope. Now, what that looks like programmatically can be in any number of different formats. And I think, you know, as I indicated earlier, there's a lot of fantastic ideas that Aaron and Jonathan and others presented earlier today. There could be the model of setting up regional workshops, a kind of train the trainer, so to speak. what we've also seen as kind of a first step, a successful first step, is creating a web-based tutorial, a kind of platform curriculum that can then be modeled in a kind of workshop or training orientation that can be delivered out in any number of different formats from there. So in terms of education and training, I think I would encourage to think big. I would also encourage to, I think one of the tricks for ENT is to be able to articulate the state of the problem, to articulate the audience that is being addressed through the educational programs that are being proposed. So for example, I heard quite a number of different levels of audiences that were being discussed earlier today, and I would recommend that the ENT section, the technical committee, go back and prioritize which audiences are need to be addressed most immediately or most urgently. I think in terms of being able to articulate the problem, I think you guys already have a great foundation with the two reports that have come out in the last few years, to be able to say where the need is, why audio preservation is in a state of sort of urgent attention at a national level. So I think you have a great foundation to work with, and we're more than happy to help articulate the programmatic needs in a more detailed fashion. In terms of research and development, the same criteria applies as you indicated, David. We look for R&D projects. Doesn't necessarily have to come from ARSC, the association. We tend to see projects come from a university or other kinds of research-oriented nonprofit organization. Bay Area Video Coalition, for example, is not your typical research university, and yet they're doing fantastic work that addresses a very high-level need in the preservation community. So what I tend to work most closely with the applicants is to be able to articulate how the R&D work that you're proposing is going to have a major impact in as wide an audience as possible. And that tends to be, we tend to see more and more, for example, the development of open source platforms or open source technologies. And I think that's absolutely the right direction to go in, and we certainly encourage that. The trick for an R&D project is to say, well, it's more than just building the tool or building the platform. You have to go beyond that. You have to give an indication of who's going to adopt the open source tools, who's going to adopt the new technologies, the new best practices, the new standards. And so I think ARSC is in a very good position to be able to articulate that and to be able to prioritize what the greatest needs in the field are in terms of new technologies, new platforms, new best practices, new standards. So I was encouraged to see, I guess, in the first panel, I believe it was Carl, asking the audience to say, what is your wish list? What is, what would you like to see as your highest priorities? And so I think if that conversation, that discussion continues and is led by, I would suppose, the technical committee, then I think you guys would be in fantastic shape to come back and be able to submit some fantastic proposals.
I want to turn something Josh said around and present it to our other panelists and to the audience as well. You mentioned the scarcity of resources, which is something we're all acutely aware of right now. I want to start out by, I don't want to say correcting something Mike Casey said yesterday, but there were, in his sort of prioritization schema for collections, the critically endangered one was 4.5 to 5, if I recall correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mike. And it was collections that you go and ask your money, your director for money to preserve. And then the next one down was apply for a grant next year to preserve it. I think we need to shift that conversation, because I think the crucial lack we have is not that there aren't enough grant funders out there, but that our own directors and administrators don't give us line item discretionary preservation money. And that may seem fantastical to us, but it shouldn't. Because if we're in a library and archive, there's a budget for binding serials, or there's a budget for kind of routine day in, day out stuff like that. And there are really very few institutions have that sort of line item. And I think we should shift those, I think Mike is right in those, but I think we should add one at the top, which is, I spend my discretionary preservation money on this year. The next one down is, I beg my director for money. And then the third one down is, I'm going to write a grant next year. And I think it's all of our jobs to reframe this conversation to our directors or deans or whoever and say, look, you're giving money to the serials department to bind their serials when that stuff isn't even falling apart. It's money down the tubes. And if every ARL institution in the country, and there's something like 160 or whatever, if we all even had, $50,000 or $100,000 a year in discretionary money that we could either use to build capacity in-house or to send it out, this would be millions and millions of dollars a year that was going for preservation. So I think I want everybody to take that away as well. But back to this other question of the scarcity of resources, what do you see as the sort of the national priorities that we need to fund? Is it radio? Is it tape collections or born digital? Or is it certain types of content versus other content, spoken word versus music? Any thoughts on that? And turn that out to the audience. I mean, you must have things as well. You're like, I've got this incredible collection, but I can't figure out what the agency is that is going to take interest. For example, you may have a regional collection that's just not quite the scope for NEH. You can't demonstrate national significance, but that doesn't mean it's not incredibly important to your community. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would qualify that a little bit, David. I think that there tends to be I wouldn't call it a misperception or misunderstanding that every collection that we fund through our digitization or preservation, the humanities collections program has to have this overall overarching national significance. I mean, I think that tends to scare away a lot of the collections that are regionally based but have quite an impact nonetheless. And so I would turn to examples like the UNC, what do we call this? The Piedmont of the Swamplands. This is their Southern Folklife collection, which is very regionally oriented in terms of the scope of the collection. But they were nonetheless able to make quite a compelling case that this collection had quite a number of different uses and quite a number of different potential value for researchers and educators. So I would encourage from the collection standpoint for institutions to be creative in terms of how they appraise their collections and to think more broadly in terms of how those collections can be used.
Did you want to address the?
No, it's okay. There's thoughts out here.
Okay.
I'm actually in the process of appealing to our dean and our library resources group for dedicated line item digitization funds right now. I've been at University of Maryland for almost a year and a half. Last year, I was relatively new with the time to ask money. So the proposal didn't go through last year, but this past year, I made sure to write in items into the strategic plan, and I'm in the process of right now of appealing to my associate dean and the library resources group to get about $50,000. Right now, we are being creative, using preservation and conservation's money to do preservation digitization. But that's tied up for a variety of other reasons, the way our university works. So it's definitely possible, but you have to start at the top. You have to start with the planning and getting your proposals into the strategic plan of your institution if you're at the institution level. I don't know how possible this is for, say, government or state, but in academia, it is definitely possible.
Yeah, I think this, you know, if you, you know, this is on the internet. Take your copy back to your dean or director and put it on their desk and highlight it. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that they pay attention to. So I think that's great that people make that appeal.
At a conference earlier this year on a different topic, I was asked about libraries and preservation and how many libraries need to preserve one item. And this is getting to NRPP chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. you know, this is, I'm interested, if we have scarcity of resources, how many of us need to be preserving the same thing, and this gets to the having a registry of what's been preserved. But I kind of want to take the question and ask rhetorically, maybe not rhetorically, whether we should be considering all duplication bad, or whether duplication is one way that we can reduce the urgency for something. Does that make sense? I'm seeing quizzical looks.
I suppose that applies more with commercially produced but rare materials rather than unique materials. I mean, I don't know that we have the capacity to be duplicating, but that brings up another question that we were considering, which was how do we share that information to know exactly what's going on and who's doing what? And there's a lot of you know, survey work that needs to be done in order to determine that before you preserve things or go out for funding for them. Did you have?
I just had a question. Does ARSC maintain some blog data area where people in the organization can say, here's a project we're working on, so that potentially somebody else working a similar project might say, you know, why don't we talk about this? Maybe we can make it a little bigger by doing it together. Is there a general kind of resource area where people can go to learn what one another are doing?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page which needs to be promoted a little bit more, and it's probably not the best place to do something like that because we'd want it to be kind of searchable and usable. So that's the only thing I can think of. So we can maybe think about adding something to the website.
There is a call for a preservation network in the plan, which would fulfill some of that role, in that if it was something was information about that preservation project or the individual items, you could look there, and it'd be kind of like checking the WorldCat to see whether anybody else had cataloged it. That's a
both cataloged it, or if anybody else is thinking of a project that you might join in on.
I don't know if I want to interject with something that I forgot, I failed to mention in terms of, I kind of want to go back to the, I almost regret having used that term, scarcity of resources. I think, you know, from our perspective, the most of the scarcity is in terms of our travel budget and sort of administrative costs at the moment, which is why I'm here and not in the audience with you guys. We do have, I know I've talked a lot about these kinds of national level or broader level projects that we're encouraging. We do have a new grant program that encourages more of the kind of foundational work that a lot of you are circling around in these last couple of questions. It's called Foundations. It is in the big grant program that we're called Humanities Collections and Reference Resources. And Foundations is encouraging the kinds of collaborative or consortial or even within a single institution assessment of the state of a certain collection or set of collections to get a better sense of building a preservation strategy around those collections. So, you know, if for lack of a better term, you can think of it as a planning grant. And these grants are for $40,000 up to, I believe, 2 years. And they allow things like what you have discussed a number of times this morning, conducting a media assessment on your campus or within your institution, building the kind of collaborative partnerships with fellow organizations or institutions in your area to say, hey, you know, we have similar collections. We all can't, digitize or preserve these collections, given our resources. Let's pool our staffing, pool our resources, and build around a single kind of consortial collection. So I do want to point that out. It's a new program for us. We just finished the first round of funding, so we do have some of our highlighted or selected projects up for you to take a look at, to read the project narrative, to get a sense of the possibilities for that grant program. And I would be happy to answer further questions about that, after the panel.
We need to wrap up the panel here and turn it over to our next presenter. Do we have any closing comments from the...
Just one additional comment. Sure. Related to what we've just been talking about. I think we need to recognize the opportunities and the requirements to not just talk among ourselves for the reasons that we've just been discussing. There are people affected by this plan that are not in ARSC, and the public, again, needs to be involved and supportive of this for it to continue and be healthy. So let's just look at our own navels as we go forward.
Any final comments or questions from the audience?
If folks are considering applying for a grant, what does the board have any resources for assistance in doing the grant, filling it out, just a little like hand-holding to get to the end of the...
The NRPB or the ARSC board?
The NRPB, I think, yeah. Is there any kind of... Nothing's built into the plan for that, I guess. I'm thinking of like CCHA and NEDCC offer free help for folks that want to do a grant for like an NEH grant. Do we know of any...
Maybe Pat can address... He's got his hand up.
I the short answer is I wish we did have the resources for that. The board's staff in the Library of Congress, which relates to the film board and the recording board, is so small, and the funding we get goes to support the work of the boards, to support the establishing the foundation. And so if we could get that kind of resource expansion in the library to do more robust outreach like that, that would be a great thing. But at this point, it's limited. Informally, we can sort of talk, and I'm happy to do that and point you to people I know in the library who have that kind of skill or expertise or advice. But at this point, it's not formal. But it's certainly something we would aspire to develop should we be able to expand this program inside the library at a higher level, which I think the Librarian of Congress would very much like to do, but I think not in the current funding environment that we're all in.
Thank you. And Josh, thanks for Skyping in. We appreciate your participation today on your Saturday off. And thanks to Al and Gerald as well for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Dean or director doesn't have a copy of the plan, I really think you should put it on their desk and make them aware of it, at least, even if they don't read it. So grab an extra and take it home with you.